Ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel operation. In September of last year, 6 Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the 6 prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The 6 escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only 2 are invested, namely Safar and Al Masila. At a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. This systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemenis suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations. As Yemenis face a fuel crash due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of 3 British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed Al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers. An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality. Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from Al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across, and that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters, but choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months,
Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Liz Truss is officially UK's next prime minister. While her nomination is certainly not the envy of the town, there are many who are questioning her leadership abilities. For example, when it comes to foreign policy. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what her approaches will be and have been on some hot-button issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Ukraine conflict, UK's relationship with the Persian Gulf countries. For example, will she put arms sales ahead of human rights? And also what she thinks about Iran and the JCPOA revival talks or the sanctions removal talks. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Hafsakara Mustafa joins us. She's a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Also joining us, President of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Hafsakar Mustafa, if I may. Taking a look at what Liz Truss will be facing in the foreign policy arena, I'm guessing the Ukraine conflict or Russia's special military operation would be probably at the top of the list. What kind of approach do you think she would take on that issue, you think?
Well, it's difficult to say, but I mean, given the examples she's given in the past as foreign secretary, I think we can fairly assume that it's not going to be a positive role or one of good leadership. She's shown herself to be a political lightweight with very little knowledge of the intricacies of foreign policy. And I think in this delicate time where any word can be interpreted and escalate a very volatile situation, I think she's obviously not a very good candidate. But of course, I think in some way, I think Russia is going to be very pleased with this nomination because it will actually add weight to their argument and the kind of politicians that they're putting on the stage. So if you put, for instance, Lavrov compared to Ms. Truss, I think you can see that Russia comes out far more stronger and has the ability to project itself as a firm and actually important international leader. And I think on that front, it puts actually Britain in a very weak spot because Britain has literally chosen as PM somebody who has very little knowledge of foreign policy. And I think at this time, it's very alarming.
What do you think, Mahmoud Rafah? Do you agree with what Hafsakar Mustafa has said there? What are your views on the way that Liz Truss may or may not approach the way the conflict in Ukraine is actually developing?
Well, let me, with all my respect to my colleague, but let me highlight very important and explicit reality. European Union countries and in front of them or on top of them, UK, number one, since 1945, the end of Second World War, are not really decision makers. The states of the European Union are not real decision makers in specific cases. One of these cases is the relationship with the other side of the world, in particular the Soviet Union and its heritage, somehow Russia now. They are not real decision makers. Also in the terrorism, also in negotiations with Iran, etc. In some cases, in the big lines, we can say, they are not the real decision makers. The real decision makers are the Americans. Orders come from Washington, D.C. And somehow, in some stages, we saw Jacques Chirac of France treating the things of invasion of Iraq differently. But at the end of the day, it's the whole European Union will not go out of the frame of the United States. And United States, and especially when I say United States, the administration President Biden is insisting to face Russia in Ukraine until the last soldier of Ukraine, okay, as President Putin said. I agree with this phrase so much. So that's why I did not imagine any European country will go out of this dilemma and to have an independent situation. We saw here in France, President Macron, at the beginning, how he wanted to get out and to overcome this issue, especially France and Russia. They have both very historical relationships since the Caesarian Russia, before the Soviet Union. That's why they have this relationship has its own specificity, but he could not. We saw the German politicians as well, how they got broken, literally broken, when they wanted to raise their voice, oh, hey, let us be aside. We will be damaged and hurt seriously, especially with the gas. They were broken, all politicians who took this approach. So I don't imagine, at the end of the day, Europe will have its own independent situation,
sure,
far away from the from the American situation.
Hafsakar Mustafa, this special relationship is something that has defined and has been described when it comes to the UK and the US. And it was surprising to me, looking at some of the coverage of this issue, which actually has turned out to be somewhat not as cordial when it comes to Liz Truss. It seems, based on, for example, this one particular source, where it said that she needed the Russian president to suffer a strategic defeat. But the U.S. has actually backed a little bit away from that talk about outright defeat of Russia. And if you remember when Joe Biden talked about how the Russian president needs to go, and then people said, well, he's advocating for regime change, and the White House had to backtrack on that. Do you think, and there's some other points that she's made on that, but how do you view it? Is Liz Truss an advocate of this special relationship with the U.S.?
I'm sorry, the sound has come and gone, so I've missed part of what you were asking. But I think in general, if we note that the reaction from the U.S. has been more or less subdued, I think it's because overall everyone accepts, and I think in Britain first and foremost, that Liz Truss is really a sort of transitional prime minister. We know that the Tory mandate has two more years to go, and therefore in replacement of Boris Johnson, she's got two more years to go. And as a result, I don't think we can imagine some sort of long-term strategy and some sort of mandate that will establish the Truss doctrine in future years to come. Hence why there's very little reaction, very little encouragement, very little sort of optimism over the nomination of Liz Truss as prime minister. I think also everyone, because everyone is very much aware that she is a lightweight on the international stage, including actually with European partners. I mean, remember just a few weeks ago, she said of France, which is, even though Britain is no longer in the EU, it nevertheless remains a close partner with France. And she said that the jury was out whether Macron was a friend of Britain or not, which is, in diplomatic terms, it's a major blunder, in particular at a time where all European countries have literally forged a front to confront Russia. So we're seeing a woman who has very little, who's not effective, who's in essence incompetent. And I think on the back of that, many world leaders not trying to put too much spotlight on her, and in order to show that they're not going to rely too much on Britain as long as this woman is in charge. And obviously, fortunately, the idea is that she won't be in charge for too long. Hence, there's no real alarm bells ringing.
Well, Mahmoud Rafat, back in September, this is what happened when Liz Truss met the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken for the first time. She questioned the special relationship, and she even said that she had seen only a few tangible examples to support the idea of this relationship to be unique, where she said Britain has better relations with Canada, Japan, and Mexico. So basically it came down to what the U.S. has done for the U.K. lately type approach. Kind of goes against what you said earlier about this relationship.
Yes, well, United States will never mind or will never put any obstacle for the Western states in general to be, I mean, European Union countries, Canada, Australia, all the West package to get complementarity, to get prosperity, to have their trade to evaluate and to get development. That the United States will never put opposition on that, because it's at the end that to strengthen the West, and just when the West is strong, the background and the backyard of the United States is strong by the strength of its allies. So that will never be opposite. But I'm talking about some cases. Look, for example, let me give a small example, the terrorism. Until our day-to-day, there is no one definition for the terrorism, despite we have country like France, it's one of oldest law states. We have country like Italy, it's one of source of law along the history. Why? Because the United States, opposite to the Western world and the human rights world, to put a definition for the terrorism in order to play as according to its interest with this idea. I'm just giving this example to understand that the West is not really allowed to go that far away from the decision and the frame of United States. And this is, by the way, this is not specific city on Americans. All winners of last world war and big empire ships around along the history behaved like that. They gathered their allies around them, and the allies played followers in specific cases and in specific matters. So this is something in the international relations that I just want to highlight on. Let me go back just to Madame Truss. Madame Truss, well, now, even without the dilemma of Ukraine, but somehow and indirectly related to the dilemma of Ukraine, the economic situation in Europe, the shortage of gas while we are very close of winter, and the most important thing, that the way of treatment of this issue, of this matter, I mean the gas matter, the energy matter. Now, a few days ago, the Minister of Economy of Germany announced, oh, hey, we have 82% in our stock now, so we are fine, we are safe. Russia cut the gas. Okay. That means the 82 can go up until 50% or even less before the winter, which is a real catastrophe on Europeans. Just yesterday, only yesterday, the Sunday, the journal, non-journal Sunday, put a comparison. Everything in UK raised the price, and everything in Russia, which is under sanction, that its prices got down, decreased its prices, like okay. food, energy, medication, everything. So that reflects something. The Prime Minister of UK, Liz Truss, is coming with paralyzed hand, literally paralyzed.
Okay, I understood your point there. All right. Well, let's move on beyond Ukraine and the obviously the domestic challenges. That's a whole nother topic for a program here, Hepzikar Mustafa. But let's move on in the foreign policy arena. Of course, they might somewhat converge somehow, but let's talk about China. Now, she is very hot.
Much of what you're saying.
Go ahead. Do you have my voice? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, but it breaks up. Please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I want to ask you about China, what you think about the hawkish approach that she obviously has towards China, not only calling for a global NATO to defend Taiwan, but also for the first time, she may come out and classify China as a threat to British national security.
That's a good point. I think we have to distinguish between Liz Truss campaigning and Liz Truss as a prime minister. As a campaigner, and obviously because she's actually a professional turncoat. She was a Remainer and then became a Brexiteer. She was a Republican and then became a monarchist. So as a campaigner, she's obviously tried to appeal to some of the base of the Tory base in order to sort of stand up and come across as very firm and everything. But of course, once in power, she becomes faced with the real politics. And Britain, like my fellow panelists said, is no longer the world heavyweight it once was many, many decades ago. I think there's no way in any way that Britain can stand up and can be this hawkish towards a country that is now not only a superpower in military terms and in nuclear terms, but even in terms of its population. So I think these were words merely for the campaign trail and for the sort of the average Tory voter, knowing that these were the people who were going to get her nominated as prime minister. But I think once in number 10, she does realize that what she said then will not apply. And she's used to that tactic. So I think there's not much to worry about in terms of Britain's relationship or hawkishness towards China.
Sure. Well, West Asia, or the Middle East region, as some like to call it, is the next issue that is going to fall into her laps there, Mahmoud Rafat. And I'm going to go with your guess as to how she has said that human rights, even though she's going to hold Persian Gulf countries to account, she said, well, it's more important to do business with them. So does that mean she's going to put that before military sales, for example? What do you think?
Well, I don't think the new prime minister will give big attention to the human rights. Let me also put a spot on a reality that we have been noticing in the West last, let's say, 7 or 8 years since what happened in Egypt of with the Muslim Brotherhood somehow. I do not want to use any term here because I do not have any situation against that to be coup d'etat or whatever, or changement of president or revolution, whatever. Since this time, since 2013, that means 9 years ago, we have been noticing that the West in general reduced the value of the human rights, because this card is no longer lucrative on the table. It used to be very lucrative to employ it against the regime of Mubarak, against Iran, against some countries here and where. Since 2013, somehow, and which is very contradictional, it happened, this decision was taken during the administration of President Obama himself, who presented himself as active of human rights. This card became not useless, but not that lucrative anymore on the table in the international relations. It's no longer the card which brings lots of benefits. That's why the West in general gave its back to the human rights, and that we have been witnessing that in lots of areas around the world. What happened in Saudi Arabia, and President Biden, who came somehow on the legitimacy that he will do 1, 2, 3 with Saudi Arabia, and then we found them inside Saudi Arabia. What we saw also what happened with Israel, and what has been happening with Israel, not what happened, but what has been happening, and allowing Israel to go more and more, deeper and deeper in the Palestinian blood and the settlement, which is the Palestinian land. So the question of human rights will not be the main interest. Okay. Maybe she will export some slogans, as usual, but on the camp of application, there will not be real application.
Very well. Well, human rights goes hand in hand when it comes to the occupied territories. Hafsakar Mustafa, she's obviously behind Israel on this. One example, when the war happened in August and Palestinians were being killed, children included, and women, she said the UK stands by Israel and its right to defend itself. So we know where that stands. What do you think? There's not going to be any difference, really, if we want to take a look between her and the way that perhaps Boris Johnson approached Israel.
Yes, I agree. I mean, unfortunately, that's where she'll probably likely to flex her muscles. I think, given that the Palestinians obviously don't have a state and they don't have the superpower that the other countries that she's flexing her muscles with doesn't apply to Palestine. And also, given that the Arab world is very fractured on that topic, especially since the Abraham Accords. So I think on that is the only area, sadly, where she's likely to sort of show hawkishness. And she's already promised that she would consider, she saw very favorably the idea of Jerusalem being considered the official capital of Israel by Britain. And I think given the power and the weight of the pro-Israel lobby domestically, that is also likely to impact her decision, because obviously, as once again, given that she is an opportunistic political lightweight, she is likely to go wherever there is support, wherever there is likely to be benefit for her. And we have seen in the past 2 years how the pro-Israel lobby destroyed Corbyn over the course of his mandate as Labour leader, that they're very much likely to view anyone who blindly supports Israel favorably and support them all the way. And therefore, she knows that that's where her bread is going to be buttered. So she's very much likely to continue in this very pro-Israel stance, which is that of the Tory party and which was that of Boris Johnson in any case.
Well, we need to talk about Iran, Mahmoud Rafat, and what she has said, which was interesting in a sense, and at the same time pretty shocking, was the fact that when it comes to the sanctions removal talk, she said, "I have been clear that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not moving fast enough." And then she says, this is the shocking part, "I assure you that if the JCPOA collapses, all options are on the table." Tell us what you think about the way that she has approached Iran with that kind of a statement. And I'd like to put that into the context of how, when it comes to her mentality, this is one of the most shocking things that she has said, and that is the fact that when it came to nuclear weapons, she said she would be ready to launch nuclear weapons as prime minister. And here she makes that statement on Iran.
Well, Madame Liz Truss, the new prime minister of the UK, is known to be a changing person, unstable person. She doesn't have one line to walk on. And that reflects somehow a very high level of pragmatism. But this pragmatism is not well directed. That means she's not, for example, the former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who unified Germany by his pragmatism. No, her pragmatism is just to win immediately. What's winning the situation? And again, let me go back to the beginning of my speech. In the case of negotiations with Iran and the situation with Israel, here Europeans are not real decision makers. They can take very small decisions, and they have very narrow space to move in, like to announce this is against international law to build the new settlement, but not really to condemn and to cut relationship and to withdraw ambassadors and to help Palestinians and to push the International Criminal Court to in order to trial war crimes in Israel committed by Israeli soldiers and army against Palestinians. That will never happen. They will not go
We're quickly running out of time. I'm sorry. Let me just address the last question to Hafsa Qamar Mostafa. Our guest there has said, Hafsa Qamar Mostafa, on numerous occasions that the EU as a whole and the UK as part of it, as part of Europe, doesn't have that much say. Now, I'm curious as to how much that's going to hold, given the precarious and fragile state that Europe as a whole is in, if the U.S. is leading it, and if that mentality that our guest there has is correct. Do you agree with his approach on the EU as a whole, if you heard my question?
I'm afraid I've only caught a few breaks of your question, but I mean, in substance, I think we have to also view the situation in light of the energy crisis that is looming. Britain is facing major disruption, and I think there is talk of major protests on a very wide scale in the coming months over the price of energy, which is now being blamed on the crisis in Ukraine. I think if the situation continues, and if we people on the street, the average Briton doesn't see its politicians willing to make sacrifices and deal with governments that they don't like, I think the reaction is going to be very violent on the street. And I think that's one thing that we need to take into account, even in regards to Iran, which is a gas producer.
Thank you for that. Hafsa Qamar Mostafa, journalist and political commentator from London, and Mahmoud Rafat, thank you, president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In recent years, the United States administration has imposed a series of measures and sanctions against Chinese technology companies as part of its strategy to curb or delay China's emergence as the world's new technology hub. According to a new study by the China Development Institute, from January of 2017, when the Trump administration took office, to June of 2021, when the Biden administration passed the United States Innovation and Competition Act, the U.S. Congress published 209 analytical reports on China's science and technology policies. These policies include sanctions on Chinese high-tech companies, regulations and restrictions on advanced technologies for teaching science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In this way, Huawei, as one of the most prominent manufacturers of Chinese communications equipment, bore a heavy burden, because one of the biggest goals of the United States sanctions has been to affect technology competition through the application of trade policies. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of world media for further details. The Asia Times has published many analytical articles about this story and elaborated more about US's wrong sanction policies against independent countries such as China as a new world power in the field of high-tech advancement. In an article published on 2nd of September, the Asia Times wrote, "In another step aimed at stifling China's technological advance, the U.S. Department of Commerce has decided to restrict shipments of advanced graphics processing units, or GPUs, designed by American companies, NVIDIA and AMD, to China. The U.S. government claims it is worried about potential military applications of these products. GPUs, or graphics processing units, are a type of integrated circuit used in graphics and video image generation, high-performance computing, and the acceleration of artificial intelligence and machine learning. NVIDIA and AMD, both based in California, are the 9th and 10th largest semiconductor companies in the world, as ranked by revenue in 2021. The stock prices of both companies dropped under sanctions news, NVIDIA's precipitously. After falling 12% intraday, NVIDIA's shares closed down 7.7% on 1st of September. AMD shares closed down 3%. Both stocks fell further in after-hours trading. However, looking ahead, these numbers make it clear that the semiconductor industry can no longer plan on selling its newest and most advanced products in China. Companies' growth prospects and return on investment may be reduced, and their share prices may thus test new lows. On 12th of August, the U.S. Commerce Department announced restrictions on exports of electronic design automation, or EDA, tools to China. This prompted Handel Jones, Chief Executive Officer of electronics industry consulting firm International Business Strategies, to write that such restrictions might have catastrophic impact worldwide, resulting in major disruptions of the global electronics industry. According to a recent report by Bloomberg News, under former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. began extensive deployment of export controls in an effort to cut off Chinese technology champions, including Huawei Technologies, from key sophisticated equipment and software. President Joe Biden continued that effort and even expanded it. Given China's manufacturing prowess, as well as its prodigious and growing ranks of engineers, this delay strategy was bound to fail without something more. Just recently, evidence emerged that China's Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation had likely advanced its production technology by two generations, despite U.S. sanctions. But the U.S. has now put some offense on the field, with President Biden recently signing the so-called Chips and Science Act, aimed at strengthening the American semiconductor industry. But for the U.S. and its desire to stay ahead of a fast-advancing China, would it be enough? J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. estimates U.S.-made chip production slid from 37% of the market in 1990 to just 12% of the market last year. U.S. officials claim that may eventually change as Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo moves to deploy $52.7 billion for research, development, manufacturing, and workforce development. The New York Times explains more about the issue, saying, "The Biden administration has imposed new restrictions on sales of some sophisticated computer chips to both China and Russia, the U.S. government's latest attempt to use semiconductors as a tool to hobble rivals' advances in fields such as high-performance computing and artificial intelligence. The new limits affect high-end models of chips known as graphics processing units, or GPUs, which are sold by the Silicon Valley companies NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices AMD. Such products were originally developed to render images in video games, but in the past decade were widely deployed in the largest supercomputers used by scientists and by internet companies for applications such as recognizing speech and objects in photographs. Supercomputers are used in applications that include weapons development and intelligence gathering. Artificial intelligence technology is also increasingly being used for purposes such as identifying faces in video images. The restrictions are part of a cold war between China and the United States for primacy in advanced technologies. The Biden administration, building on limits begun under former President Donald J. Trump, has adopted measures aimed at restricting access by companies such as China's Huawei, to advanced chips and foreign semiconductor manufacturing. Moreover, a recent report by Japan's Science and Technology Ministry shows China has overtaken the United States as the world leader in both scientific research output and high-impact studies. According to the report published by Japan's National Institute of Science and Technology Policy, China now publishes the largest number of scientific research papers yearly, followed by the United States and Germany. The report said China published a yearly average of 407,181 scientific papers, pulling ahead of the United States' 293,434 journal articles and accounting for 23.4% of the world's research output. China also accounted for a high proportion of research into materials science in chemistry, engineering, and mathematics. The figures are based on yearly averages between 2018 and 2020. Shinichi Kuroki of the Japan Science and Technology Agency told Nikkei Asia that China is one of the top countries in the world in terms of both the quantity and the quality of scientific papers that it publishes. Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden signed the Chips and Science Act, legislation that would authorize more than $200 billion in research funding over 10 years to make U.S. scientific research more competitive with China. U.S. lawmakers passed the $280 billion Chips and Science Act out of fear that China was about to overtake the United States in scientific and technological expertise. But the recently released study suggests China was already beating the United States in this field. Chinese President Xi Jinping has prioritized investments in research and development in an effort to make China more self-sufficient. The country spent a record $441.3 billion on research and development in 2021.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.